and literature. We have the Nancy Wilson Room, the Joe Williams Room, the Gloria Lynn Room, the Frank Sinatra Room, the B.B. King Blues Room, the James Baldwin Library, just to name a few. Join me Friday nights from 7 until 10 p.m. as I take you on a musical journey you'll never forget. Robin's Place.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
The genocide in Gaza rages on. The occupation in D.C. continues. We will talk with activists on the front lines. Civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump has endorsed the struggle to stop the desecration of Moses Cemetery, and attorney David Shapiro, a civil rights warrior, transitions to ancestor, a tribute. Stay tuned. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm your host, Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo. I'm with you the fourth Wednesday of each month. We have a powerful and impactful show today, one that we would like for you to share with your network. We will first start with breaking news at both the local and international levels. As you are aware, the desecration of Moses African Cemetery is still continuing unabated. Montgomery County Executive Mark Elridge and Congressman Jamie Raskin have refused to work with the community to stop this atrocity. Not a single elected official in Montgomery County or Maryland have stepped forward to denounce this heinous crime against Black humanity. But yesterday, civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump, the attorney that represented the families of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, George Floyd, and Breonna Taylor, Twittered his support on X for the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition's struggle to stop the desecration of Moses African Cemetery. We are extremely thankful to Mr. Trump for his support, Mr. Crump, for his support, and we ask his support in the struggle against white supremacy and erasure of Black history and Black people. Attorney Crump wrote, "Over 500 Black souls lie beneath a parking lot in Bethesda, Maryland, land taken from the Moses African Cemetery. Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo and the Macedonia Baptist Church are fighting to reclaim it. Black lives must matter in life and in death." So we thank Mr. Crump for standing with the community, and we look forward to winning this battle. Next, we turn to the struggle and the genocide in Gaza. Our guest co-host, is Ari Gutman, a writer, advocate, and BACC organizer. Good morning, Ari.
Good morning, Marsha.
I am so excited about the next interview. So please, the floor is yours.
This week, nearly 2 years after the Al-Aqsa flood, which marks a growing escalation of the U.S. Zionist genocide of Palestinians, multiple Anglo-European states, including the U.K., France, and Canada, declared their recognition of the state of Palestine, joining the global majority of more than 144 states who had already done so. A statement put out by UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer this past Sunday reads, "In the face of the growing horror in the Middle East, we are acting to keep alive the possibility of peace and of a two-state solution. Despite his words, the UK continues to collaborate with the Zionist regime by frequently flying spy planes over Gaza, directly collaborating with the occupation forces. The UK, alongside the other European states who are now attempting to force the so-called two-state solution back into headlines after decades of providing military, economic, and diplomatic cover to the Zionist regime's theft of Palestinian, Lebanese, and Syrian land, were a main focal point of this week's UN General Assembly, during which multiple states and leaders, primarily from the Global South, publicly condemned the Zionist regime for its genocide of Palestinians. A week prior, the United States once again vetoed a UN resolution demanding an immediate, unconditional, and permanent ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. It was the only state to do so. Despite the hypocrisy and complicity of Western leaders, millions of people around the world have not stopped taking action and using their voices to resist what many are calling the first ever live-streamed genocide. Salma Shawa, a Palestinian content creator born and raised in Gaza, has been helping her more than 300,000 followers think past the headlines and the obfuscations of mainstream narratives. Yusuf Samur, a Palestinian living in New Zealand, is a current participant in the Global Samud Flotilla, a coalition of everyday people, organizers, humanitarians, doctors, artists, clergy, lawyers, and seafarers who believe in human dignity and have decided to take nonviolent action. He and dozens of ships are currently en route to Gaza carrying humanitarian supplies, steadfast in their goal to break the genocidal siege. Yusuf and Salma, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Ari. It's great to be here.
Yusuf, I'd like to start with you. You are currently on board a ship headed to Gaza. I know there have been some urgent updates in the past 12 hours. Could you tell us what we need to know and how you and your crewmates are doing?
Yeah, hi. We're all doing fine, given what's happened in the past 12 hours. We are seven people on board a 42-foot sailing yacht called Ulara. And if you go to the Global Samud Flotilla website, there's a live tracker of all of our ships that's being updated in real time, so you can keep track on how we're doing and how we're progressing. In the past 12 hours, last night, essentially, as we were making our way in formation, several ships were attacked by drones. There was a bit of a panic state. Ulara itself was attacked. There were 14 attacks in total. And three of them were chemical attacks, kind of a sulfuric acid kind of attack that smells really horrible, like rotten eggs, if you remember that from chemistry class in high school. And the 11 other attacks were physical explosions that were incredibly loud. Four vessels have undertaken significant damage. We're currently assessing the damage itself. The good news is nobody was seriously injured on board any of the ships, and we are all full steam ahead, continuing our way. And some breaking news is the Italian Navy has sent a ship an hour ago, has stated that they will send a ship to kind of protect us on our way past the European waters. I'm not sure how far they'll come with us, but that's a huge breakthrough where and a European country sends an actual military vessel to accompany us. That's never happened before in any flotilla. And this is my third flotilla. So this is great news. And we're all doing fine.
And I think, you know, it speaks to the Italian people really organizing a general strike and militant action to push their government to support the flotilla in this way. So I also want to recognize the organizing taking place on the ground. This is the largest maritime mission ever attempted. And we know that there are people in Gaza who are waiting for Yusuf and his crewmates to arrive. Salma, could you tell us what you are hearing from people in Gaza about the current situation on the ground? What are people in need of, and why do you think the occupation is taking such criminal and violent action to prevent humanitarian aid from reaching them?
Yeah, I mean, the situation is pretty tough right now because people are being forced to flee for, I don't know, the 100th time from the north of Gaza to the south. And people really have nowhere to go because Israel is flattening all the very big residential towers in Gaza. And people are struggling to even find tents to stay in. So it's really, really tough right now with housing, especially, and even transportation. Like, I have lots of friends and family who are struggling to even get from the north to the south because they simply have no vehicle to get transported in, since there's no gas, there's no buses or anything like that. It's really, really hard to find transportation. So, and the bombardments are, of course, continuing. Just the other day, Israel bombed a medical relief building and more than 60 people got killed. And that coincided with the same time that the European states were recognizing Palestine as a state. So there's a lot of, I just feel that the international community is so detached from the reality on the ground with, you know, the statements they're making and their acts of recognition, and the symbolism behind it is not really translating into anything material on the ground to stop the genocide. And I think, you know, to your question about why is Israel acting with this much impunity? I mean, they've always acted with this much impunity. It's just, it's to a different degree right now, and they keep doing more and more and more and killing more people, displacing more people. And I think their goal is very clear from the beginning, which is displacing and killing as many Palestinians as possible in an attempt to possibly annex Gaza. And that's what we're seeing. I mean, people are having to leave their ancestral homeland. And the implication of that is Palestinian families are being ripped apart and torn into pieces. So, you know, you look at a Palestinian family right now from Gaza, and let's say a family has six members. Some of them are killed. Maybe they're under the rubble, not to be found yet. Some of them evacuated to Egypt when the Rafah border was open. Some of them are in the south. Some are in the north. Some are seeking asylum in the U.S. or Canada or Europe. Like, it's Israel has destroyed the social fabric of a Gazan family unit, and it's the most devastating thing to have happened to Palestinians, to be honest.
And to your point about the failure of the international, you know, community to meet this moment, you know, I'm thinking about why something like the Samud Flotilla had to be formed. Yusuf, could you talk about the history of previous missions to break the siege on Gaza? And if you could both talk a bit about the siege and how it has impacted life in Gaza. You just, you know, spoke to this, Salma, but how it has impacted life in Gaza, not only in the last 2 years, but prior?
Yes, the flotilla started in 2008 under the Ship to Gaza movement, which was then superseded by the Freedom Flotilla Coalition in 2010. In 2010, the Mavi Marmara, which was a Turkish vessel carrying hundreds of people, was boarded illegally in international waters by the Israeli occupation with helicopters, with Zodiacs, with boats, and 10 people were murdered by the army. And there was little repercussions, again, like Salma said, with total impunity. And ever since then, there's been more media attention and more eyes on these flotillas. And every year or two, when they can save up enough money through donations and grassroots events to raise the funds to purchase vessels and boats, they attempt to break the siege again. And the quote or kind of phrase that we're all using, that we've been using in the past and that we're using now, is when the governments fail, we sail. Because we shouldn't be doing this. This is not normal. We civilians and artists and doctors and nurses and sailors should not be taking it upon themselves to risk their lives for the sake of an occupation, an apartheid, racist, supremacist regime. This should be done by the UN, by all the peacekeeping entities that have been created since World War II, specifically to stop these things from happening again. And the silence and the powerlessness of all of these entities in this specific case is eye-opening and has opened the eyes of so many people, specifically since October 7th. And this is why this movement this year has been so massive, because everybody now knows what's happening and everybody wants to be part of it. And the mobilization that's happened in the past 4 months, and I've been part of the movement since the beginning of its inception in June, has been incredible. I mean, in reality, this should have happened 78 years ago, right? But it's happening now. better late than never, and hopefully it's not too late to help actually help the people in Palestine. Again, I want to reiterate, just to support Salma's speech just now, this is not about us. This is not about any of us except the Palestinians in Gaza. We're all doing this because we want to help those people. They can help themselves, but the world is not doing anything about it. The systems that are in place to stop these things from happening is not doing anything about it. So we need to do everything we can, everything in our power. And me as a sailor and as a Palestinian person, it's my duty to be on this ship. It's my duty to keep doing this. And everyone else who's not Palestinian feels the same as well. It's not about religion or race or anything other than the basic humanity, basic decency, and the basic black and white of what's right and what's wrong, who the bullies are, and who the people being bullied are. And this is why we're here.
Salma, you spoke briefly about, you know, that the international community is now deciding, or rather not the international community, but primarily Western states are now deciding to recognize a Palestinian state, as if this is some sort of band-aid over the last 2 years of, you know, destroying, as you mentioned, the social fabric of the Palestinian family. What do they mean by a Palestinian state? And do you think this will have any impact on the people of Gaza, you know, right now?
I mean, that's, I think, the question we all have. What do they mean by a Palestinian state when you're effectively killing Palestinians to this very moment? I mean, one of the rules of statehood is that you need a population. If you're exterminating that population, then where is the state? And then also, when you think of like any state, a big part of it is being able to enter into relations, like trade relations, with other states and countries, right? So how is that possible when, on the one hand, the West Bank is occupied, there's, you know, military occupation with the checkpoints, restrictions on movement, on trade, and in Gaza you have a genocide where there aren't even homes left, so let alone enter into trade, when we don't have control over our seas. So the recognition doesn't really make sense. I mean, I'm trying to understand what they mean by it at this time, when what we really need, what people in Gaza need, is an end to the genocide and an end to the blockade. Like, those are the things that we have been demanding for the past 2 years, and not the symbolism of recognizing a state that they have really decimated the population of. And I also want to mention that, you know, for Palestinians, the way that we look at Palestine is more connected to the idea of land. Like, we conceptualize Palestine as a land, not as just a state with drawn up borders by Western powers, right? And an essential part of our land is the farmer, the trees, the nature. Like, that is what Palestine is to us. And I think that's what land means to many indigenous people around the world, whether it's, you know, Native Americans, where that is their idea of land. It's not just the borders that get drawn up. And right now, our land is being destroyed. We don't have that land. Our olive trees are bulldozed. Our farmers are unable to farm and provide sustenance for the Palestinian population. So the recognition is not guaranteeing this land for us. So if, to me, at least, it doesn't mean anything. And if it's not ending the genocide, then I just see it as a way for Western powers to actually reward Israel and to show us that, you know what, we're not decolonizing Palestine, and we're not really acknowledging that this is colonialism. But instead, we're going to keep arming Israel. We're going to keep funding it. We're going to keep sending our dollars or pounds or whatever currency these Western powers have to Israel while they bombard you. But then we're going to give you this crap of a recognition.
And to your point, you know, I always find it so interesting when Western leaders say, well, if we give the Palestinians a state, right, which is already to begin with, if we give the Palestinians a state, as if it's the Western leaders who are supposed to bestow people around the world statehood, it's rewarding the Palestinian resistance to their genocide, right? But the same question is never posed to the Zionists of, you know, why do you continue to be, you know, you are conducting a genocide, and yet we will continue to reward you with money, resources, diplomatic cover, you know, everything they need. I just find the double standard to be so disturbing and racist, quite frankly. Yusuf, you are just a normal person, like you said, taking on what should really be the responsibility of the UN. And I think there are millions of people out there wondering what they can do to support the people of Palestine in this moment. You know, what would you say to those people?
Thanks, Ari. Yeah, there's a million things you can do. Like what we're doing now, this flotilla is one of the dozens of things that can be done. Attending rallies and protests and mobilizing in your home countries, if you live in a democracy, quote unquote, where you can talk to your local members of parliament, local mayors, local government officials to push the narrative that what's happening needs to stop, to get them to say the word genocide, the G word that nobody wants to mention after 2 years, which is utterly ridiculous, and to impact change in any way that you can. Any skill that you have, any tool that you have, video editing, social media, if you're a lawyer, if you're a medic, this whole thing needs all of us because nobody else is doing anything about it, right? And we need to do something about it. The other thing that I would mention is the UN has a year ago issued a clarification or an order for Israel to withdraw to its previous borders in the West Bank. How can you have a two-state solution? How can you recognize Palestine as a state when there is no state left in the West Bank, when the only Palestinian territories that are left are scattered small areas that are controlled by a checkpoint with no freedom of movement under military law? The people there are living under military law. There is no state that can be declared under the current situation. They had 12 months to withdraw, and instead of withdrawing, a couple of months ago, they seized another 30,000 hectares. Almost as a, here's what we think about this kind of response. So Gaza and the genocide aside, which is impossible to say, really, to put it aside. But if you just consider what's happening in the West Bank, it's impossible to have a two-state solution. It's physically impossible. There is no way unless they withdraw to their previous agreed borders, 1967 borders. That aside, you can't even have a two-state solution with a Zionist murderous regime. There's an ICC arrest warrant for Netanyahu and his members of parliament. How do you expect anyone to live side by side with such an entity? It's completely implausible. I mean, all these people, all these countries that are declaring a Palestinian state, they're just trying to save face, and they're just trying to go with the tide that is turning drastically before they, like, they're trying to save themselves from exposing themselves to what they've been complicit in for far too long. So I would say mobilize, act, and do whatever you can with the tools that you have to contribute to making this change happen faster, because it is happening and we all know that it is.
Thank you so much, Yusuf. And just before we close, I would like, you know, Salma, if you have anything else you'd like to add.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Yusuf said, and I think we just need urgent action and people. I really urge people to do what they can with what they have as much as possible. We can all contribute, even if it's small or big, especially if you're living in Western countries. So, you know, protest, boycott, the BDS movement is growing and it's seeing some wins, and of course, support the Freedom Flotilla. Yeah, thank you so much for this.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Yusuf Samud from the Global Samud Flotilla and Salma Shawa. It's been, you know, a really great, you know, hearing you both, you know, speak not only about the current situation in Palestine, but also the work that activists are doing around the world to support the people, not only of Palestine, but the people of the world who don't want to live in a society where genocide and ethnic cleansing is normalized. So thank you both so much. And I'm passing it back to you, Marcia.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Ari.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ari. Incredible interview. We will take a break for the social justice calendar.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of September 22nd, 2025. Wednesday, September 24th is Pan-African Community Action's next Asaf Shakur Study Group session, Community Control Over Public Safety Part 2, Resistance to Trump and Bowser Must Be for Power, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Black Workers and Wellness Center on 2500 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More information and registration is on people-centered-public-safety-part-2.eventbrite.com. Thursday, September 25th is a book discussion hosted by the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Demand Progress, and Progressive Talent Pipeline, a conversation between Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Greg Grandin and author and journalist Ryan Grimm, discussing Grandin's latest New York Times bestseller, America, America, A New History of the New World. The event takes place from 6 to 8 p.m. at Busboys and Poets, 450 K Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. More info is available at cepr.net/events/. On Friday, September 26th from 3 to 7 p.m., United Workers of Washington, D.C., together with many other organizations and friends, invite the community to celebrate the life of Arturo Griffiths, an Afro-Latino who immigrated to D.C. from Panama, who was a longtime community and union organizer and a freedom fighter. This will take place at All Souls Church, 1500 Harvard Street, with a march to Amigos Park at 4 and a repast at All Souls from 5 to 7 p.m. For more info, please visit www.tuwdc.org. Saturday, September 27th, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., join St. Paul United Methodist Church for Community Day 2025 at 2601 Colston Drive, Chevy Chase, Maryland, at the corner of East West Highway and Grub Road in Chevy Chase, Maryland. More info at 301-587-5370. Also on Saturday, September 27th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., there will be a book event titled W.E.B. Du Bois, Ethiopianism and Black Internationalism, a new interpretation of the global color line, located at Sankofa Video and Books Cafe on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit Sankofa.com. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo. I'm with you the fourth Wednesday of each month. My next guest is Joseph Morgan. Joseph was born and raised in Washington, D.C. Joseph has been organizing with the Pan-African Community Action, PACA, since early 2024. Welcome, Joseph, to What's at Stake.
Yes, thank you, Marsha. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. Thank you for being with us today. Let's start off with you helping us understand the mission of PACA, its history, and some of the work you're doing, particularly around this recent issue of growing militarization and the occupation
yes.
of these streets by the National Guard.
Okay, so starting off, Pan-African Community Action, APACA, we're a grassroots organization based in Southeast D.C. trying to achieve community-based power. Power is central to our work. We understand that the reason that African or Black people have the life experiences or material reality that they do, you know, such as economic deprivation, poor housing, poor health, so on and so forth, it's because we do not have power and more. We have a colonized relationship to the U.S., you know, one of powerlessness that mimics, you know, a classic colonial situation that you would see like in Asia or Africa, for example. How we started, PACA's 10-year-old organization. Unfortunately, there was a brother who was killed, Alonzo Smith, by special police in D.C., and so PACA really began centered around this Justice for Zoe campaign. And I think the last piece of that was what we're doing around the federalization of D.C. I guess maybe not anything specific, but going back to our understanding of power, you know, we are advancing our community control over health campaign of forces by Trump. And we have to, as African people, take power to combat local forces or federal forces, and the local forces specifically, they were advancing this war on African people as we understand it before the Trump administration.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually, you know, I live in Maryland. Mm-hmm. And so, and I don't go into sort of the heart of DC very often, like once or twice a week. And so I saw the troops with their submachine guns, I guess, or machine guns, outside of the George Washington Hospital last week. And when I started asking questions about why the troops were there in that particular location, because I had been told that most of the troops were by Union Station or the mall. So I was a little surprised when I saw it was like 7 or 8 military troops with their guns, just, you know, in open display. I wonder, why are you standing near a hospital? I mean, it was just sort of a strange place to find troops. And I was then told that one of the reasons why the troops stand there is because the area where they were located is where there was formerly a, you know, a homeless shelter encampment. And they were standing there basically to intimidate anyone who wanted to come back, a homeless person or person who's without shelter, from coming back to that location. And I just thought, isn't that the irony of all ironies? I mean, here is someone who has lost everything and they're living on the street, and the government sends troops with guns to intimidate this person who is already so vulnerable. I don't know if you want to comment on that, but that to me was just such an obscene way of projecting power, as you talk about.
For sure. No, just a brief comment. It's interesting. I've been to, unfortunately, had to go to the hospital a few times recently. There's been a large police presence. I was at Howard. There were FBI in there, police, you know, and they were policing homeless folks, as I understand it. But again, this is just indicative of not just Trump, but the U.S. settler colonial project. This is indicative of their war on, you know, we know D.C., though much less, is still a predominantly African black city. So this is just, you know, imposition, further imposition of that militarized power upon African people, upon working class people, upon homeless people, that, again, extends beyond just the Trump administration.
So what are you hearing from people about how they're being impacted by what PACA has referred to as the colonial occupation or militarization of D.C.? I mean, what are folks in our community saying about this?
Yes. You know, fears around deportations, of course. Someone in my building, as I understand it, ICE broke into their apartment, and they have fear of returning because of this. You know, the arrest of course, African or black people, especially youth. And so just these fears around, you know, criminalization, deportation and targeting. And, you know, I keep plugging the fact that there is this other side of the coin that it exists at the local level. And, you know, we can think about how this war on working class African people is advanced at the local level when we think about the fact that, for instance, recently, you know, a 13% pay increase was authorized for MPD. We can think about
what is MPD?
Metropolitan Police Department. And just even thinking of, you know, in 2024, there was a piece of legislation, the Secure DC Crime Bill, that authorized drug-free zones, of course, targeting racialized and African people, and things like that. Even recently, MPD has just been recently authorized to conduct high-speed car chases, which are, you know, deadly for those being pursued as much as anyone in the vicinity. So again, I know I'm probably sounding like a broken record, but just want to emphasize this this complicity that exists between at the local and the federal level.
And so how are local government officials, such as Mayor Bowser and the DC City Council, responding to this occupation? And the second part of that question is, have they been receptive to the pushback by DC residents?
How they're responding, you know, ultimately, local leadership, especially, you know, thinking of Mario Bowser and as part of the Blackness leadership clash, you know, these political figures who are a part of the power structure, you know, the status quo that disadvantages Black working class people. So how they respond to it, you know, Mario Bowser, for instance, recently created a, I guess, an organ, you can call it, that facilitates the collaboration between these federal and local forces beyond the, excuse me, beyond Trump's declared emergency. So how they're responding to it is they are reinforcing it as they did before. You know, their this Blackness leadership democratic policy is what lays the foundation for the more intensified repression that we see. You know, we can think of like past tough on crime policy and how this is just, this has walked us to where we are now, unfortunately, this more repressive, this neo-fascist reality that we're living in. And then,
you know, and I was going to say, I think about the governors, the governor of Maryland, for example, signed two bills. One was an a bill that would allow, I think, children as young as 10 to 12 to be tried as adults, which is, you know, insane. And then, you know, and then, of course, you know, we, you know, we have the, you know, the pushback on any kind of concept of Black people receiving, you know, monetary benefits or just being even an apology for the kind of cruelty and inhumanity that Black people have faced over the last hundreds of years. And so I love the fact that you're talking about the mismanagement class, the Black mismanagement class. And so then, but how do Black people push back on this? Because aren't we the ones electing? I mean, in terms of percentage, aren't we the ones electing these people
to
carry out these policies?
Yes. And before I answer your question, I'm glad you mentioned those last two pieces, because also D.C. is this legislation has just been passed that allows kids as young as 14 to be tried as adults. So, and, you know, we could think of Mario Bowser's, you know, these existing youth, summer youth curfews, and even more recently, this youth curfew has been extended by the D.C. Council into the fall. So, again, you know, criminalization, harassment, targeting of Black working class people is the status quo, no matter who is in power, no matter whether it's, you know, whether it's a Democrat or Republican. So I definitely appreciate you for reminding me of that. But pivoting to your question, so as I mentioned earlier, African or Black people in the U.S., you know, we were brought here forcefully, of course. And so I have a colonized status in relation to the U.S. You know, we were brought here by force. You know, the reason we were brought here was economic. I mean, even today, it's still economic. You know, think you know, the pennies we're paid for the labor we do, working in the service economy, the gig economy. And so, connecting to what I was saying earlier, we profoundly have a lack of control over our communities, over our lives. We don't control the police who abuse us. We don't control the grocery stores. You know, we were organizing Ward 7 and 8, and they're only three full service grocery stores. We don't have any say of that. You know, we don't have any say of economic policy. We don't have any say of over, you know, the economy and the jobs we can get, or the the pay we might receive, thus resulting in a myriad of issues, you know, poor health, poor housing, so on and so forth. So what we as African or Black people need to do is we need to be concerned with power. And power, as Paca defines it, is the ability to have an idea and to put that idea, to make that idea a reality, and then also protect that outcome. So, for instance, we have to have institutions, you know, like our own healthcare institutions that we control that are responsive to us. We have to have a public safety force that is not responsive to the people in power, that but that is responsive to us, and that comes from our community. So ultimately, we have to build institutions that are grounded in the will of the people and that are beholden to the will of the people, and in which the people have decision-making ability. That's ultimately how we deal with this federal takeover, or how we deal with local forces that assail us as well.
I mean, but you clearly see the occupation as being an aggressive move by the state. I mean, yes. It's, so for example, PACA has long called for community control of the police.
Yes.
Could you talk a bit about what that might look like and how it differs from the current model of policing that we're used to?
Yes. As I was just saying, you know, community control over the police means the people would choose the people would choose those who are the public safety officers. The people would develop policy and procedures. The people would have a say in, you know, the budgets and priorities. So in comparison to what exists, you know, we know that police brutality is a factor. We know that police brutality is, you know, abundant. Police killing is abundant. And so it would look like a police force that doesn't have this as a permanent feature, because the reason this police brutality can happen, this police killing can happen, is because, again, our lack of power and the fact that the police don't answer to us. They answer to those in power. They answer to the Blackness leadership class. They answer to the political power structure in D.C. that is ultimately beholden to white supremacy, capitalism, anti-working class and anti-working class sentiments.
Right. So, in your statement, you refer to Trump's increase in military spending and the U.S. military occupation in Africa. Have you been you've been concerned about AFRICOM, obviously, because that is in many ways another expression of imperialism.
Yes.
A 21st century expression of imperialism in Africa. So how should we understand what's happening in D.C. as part and parcel of what the U.S. is doing in Africa or abroad? Or are they completely different phenomenons?
They're the same phenomenon, just, you know, in different places. But, you know, I keep referring to us as Africans because that's what we are. You know, we were forcefully taken from Africa. So we are African people being assaulted by the U.S. in the same way that African people on the continent are being assaulted by the U.S., by the militarization of Africa through AFRICOM. Another parallel is, you know, this misleadership class in D.C., you know, and elsewhere, there's this misleadership class that allows for, you know, our continued subjugation, oppression. Same thing on the continent. You know, we can even think of like Ruto in Kenya, you know, with the austerity measures that are advanced that harm the people. I mean, it's the same thing here. Like, look at what gentrification has done to African people in D.C. Look at what, you know, increased funding to the police continues to do to African people. So it is a similar phenomenon. And it's a similar phenomenon. We're African people without power. We're African people that whose communities are occupied, whether by U.S. military or whether by U.S. police. I think Malcolm said, you know, Malcolm X, that is, said the military does abroad what the police do domestically.
Very well said. And what are some of the ways the DMV community can pursue you know, some of the goals of what you're talking about. I mean, I know that when I saw the military, I mean, I used to work in Africa. And but I remember once being in sort of a situation in Uganda, you know, where you're constantly confronted with guns in your face. And it's intimidating because you've got to make a decision whether or not you're going to concede that power to the people with guns or whether or not you're going to survive that encounter, right? And that's a real situation for people. Yeah. So what is your prescription? I mean, what is PACA? How is PACA helping people survive and get through this period of militarization? And do you see an end to this militarization unless people begin to think about alternatives to what we're looking at right now?
I'm going to answer the second one just because it's freshest. An end to the militarization? No, there's no end to the militarization until people organize, until we assume power, you know, power over our communities. The reason the police force can be federalized against us is because we don't have power. You know, there's a phrase, monopoly of force or violence. You know, the state has the monopoly of force or violence, so they can impose themselves and their will upon us. And that's why community control over public safety is necessary. We have to be able to attend to the needs of our community as much as we have to be able to protect our communities from what I consider to be, you know, the illegitimate power structure that exists as colonized peoples. And then can you repeat your first question, please?
Well, I guess I was just trying to figure out how do people survive these kinds of situations, because we all have to make decisions, particularly in D.C., on a day-to-day basis. You see police there with guns in their hands. I know what my reaction, if I can sort of take this to a first person reaction, was to take pictures of them.
Yeah.
And that was my form of resistance, was to take a picture of them, right? It could have been more aggressive, it could have been whatever, but that was my personal reaction. And they didn't like the fact that I was obviously taking pictures of them. Mm-hmm. And basically their body language told me, stop it. Mm-hmm. Stop taking pictures of us. And there's nothing illegal that I was doing, but they have guns and I didn't.
Of course.
Right? So I'm just asking, you know, how do we prepare our community to survive, to resist and survive at the same time?
Yeah, and I sound like a broken record, but striving for power. And, you know, again, just want to expand our understanding. Of course, the federalization, and that's you know, what's happening. And that's not to downplay it, but, you know, the reality of African people in the U.S. has been brutal since we came here. You know, slavery, Jim Crow, sharecropping, and ultimately what we have to do to survive even beyond this federalization is we have to challenge capitalism, and we have to challenge white supremacy and the U.S. power structure, because this, you know, like I said, it whether at the local or federal level, it manifests as, you know, the state force deployed against us. It manifests as the lack of food. It manifests as the poor food, as the housing. So we have to come together. We have to organize. We have to build programs to satisfy the needs of the people. In this case, you know, a very relevant program would be, of course, public safety, again, to defend our community, especially from those outside of our community. But that's essentially that, just building, you know, coming together, because we have strength in numbers. And with this strength in numbers, we can build institutions, and the institutions necessarily have to be run, managed, and driven by the people. And that's why organization is important. That's why organization is a must.
I guess, you know, I'm beginning to understand from this interview that you see the occupation, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that you see the occupation as just another sort of episode or another attack against the Black community. But what you really are talking about is a paradigm of many attacks, many episodes, and that you do not necessarily see this particular one as standing outside of just the total pattern of life for African people in this country. Is that correct?
Yeah, essentially, you know, of course, every episode in history has its particular features. So again, not to downplay it, but yes, this is this is an episode in the grand pattern that is, you know, the brutalization of African people in the U.S. And we have to brave this as we, you know, did before. I mean, we think of the civil rights movement. We think of organization. We think of the Black Power movement. We think of organization. And specifically, you know, we think of the Panthers, whose legacy we walk in, and them building people-centered, people-ran programs. That's what PACA is striving to do.
Well, thank you so much, Joseph Morgan. We appreciate you coming on and sharing your thoughts and strategies with us. So thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day. I'd like to take a moment to pay tribute to civil rights attorney David H. Shapiro, who transitioned to Ancestor on September 7th. David represented numerous federal employees that brought complaints of civil rights and whistleblower retaliation against the United States government. He was a fierce and unrelenting champion for those courageous enough to file a lawsuit with the expectation of facing the predictable retaliation. David played a central role in creating the environment for the passage of the No Fear Act, the first civil rights and whistleblower law of the 21st century. We send our condolences to David's family and friends and raise our fist in honor of someone who took on power in defense of federal employees who fought for justice within the U.S. government. David, rest in power. That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Ari, great to have you on as the co-host. Your interview was moving.
I think today's show, Marcia, really highlights the fact that, you know, communities in DC are facing very, very similar, obviously at very different degrees, levels of violence, and that the protagonist in all of this is the people, and that the assailant is, you know, the increasingly militarized and belligerent, you know, United States government, who quite frankly does not view, you know, working class Black people, working class colonized people as human, and is willing to deploy extreme levels of violence to quell any form of resistance. So I think Joseph and Salma and Yosef kind of all spoke to that reality, and what we have to do as just normal working class people to make sure we can survive. And if we have one moment, Joseph wants to speak, if that's okay.
We don't.
Okay.
Joseph, is bring you on again, and then we'll.
Yes, absolutely.
That gives us an excuse to invite you back.
Sounds great.
Thank all of our guests, executive producer Verna Avery Brown. This program is engineered by Mr. Michael Nasella. I'm Marcia Coleman Adebayo. We are celebrating the 23rd anniversary of the passage of the No Fear Act, the first civil rights and whistleblower law of the 21st century. WPFW supports whistleblowers.
What's it do if you're approached by the police?
We deserve to be safe in our neighborhoods.
Follow these tips to assert your rights.
If you're being stopped, detained, or arrested, the best thing to say is nothing.
Stick to only these questions. Am I free to go? If stopped by law enforcement, try to leave the conversation as quickly and safely as possible.
Ask, am I free to go?
If yes, walk away calmly and quietly. Running away could give them pretext to detain you. Officers may try and incite a reaction. Ignore them. Knowing your rights is a great first step.
And asserting your rights is even better.
Appeal Incorporated presents its 8th Annual Founders Day Celebration with dinner and a show on Sunday, September 28th at 4 p.m. featuring Sahel, Anna Mualago, Bamani Armah, Kaba Soul Singer, and DJ One Love at the Thurgood Marshall Center, 1816 12th Street Northwest. Details, including how to join virtually, at appealinc.org or 800-711-7851.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. Support from listeners like you are the tools that have built WPFW over nearly 5 decades. We provide news, music worth listening to, and in-depth conversations about your community and the world. One of the many ways that you could contribute is to donate a vehicle that you no longer need, running or not. It can do wonders for WPFW, so donate it for a tax break for 2024. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This is Ronald Hampton, convener of IBW's Police Justice and Accountability Task Force. Are you sick and tired of Trump's occupation of Washington, D.C. and other chocolate cities around the country? IBW is convening an emergency summit to address this urgent issue. Saturday, September the 27th, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, sharp at the historic New York Avenue Presbyterian Church, 1313 New York Avenue Northwest in Washington, D.C. Speakers include Dr. Julian Malveaux, Sonia Pruitt, Kimon Freeman, Denise Rolock Barnes, and more. That's Saturday, September the 27th, 1 p.m. sharp at the historic New York Avenue Presbyterian Church. Doors open at 12:30 p.m. Details at ibw21.org.
The Can I Kick It outdoor summer movie series presented by Shaolin Jazz is back and is coming to Southeast D.C. for the first time ever. Enjoy 3 nights of martial arts and action films, scored live with hip-hop, soul, and more, mixed by WPFW alum DJ Two Tone Jones. Saturday, September 20th at Skyland Town Center with a screening of Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon. Then on Saturday, October 25th, the series concludes with the screening of I'm Gonna Get You Sucker at the Capitol Hill Boys Club Artist Gallery. Each event begins at 7 p.m. with a guest DJ set, followed by the movie at 8:30 p.m. Blankets and lawn chairs are welcome. For more details, visit ShaolinJazz.com. ShaolinJazz.com.
Hi, I'm Renee Bowser, a staunch trade unionist and host of a new WPFW program, Unionism Drives Community, airing Thursdays at 5 p.m. We will share the importance of knowing your rights in the workplace, the impact of unionism on working class advancement beyond the workplace, and how unionism can activate robust community among all of us. That's Unionism Drives Community, Thursdays at 5 p.m. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Attention all parents and youth in the Washington, D.C. area. Looking for a creative, inspiring after-school program? The Word Speeds and Life Academy in Columbia Heights fall session begins September 22nd. For ages 8 to 18, we offer classes in poetry, DJing, graffiti art, college prep, and more. Elementary classes are Mondays and Tuesdays, with youth and young adults on Wednesdays, 3:30 to 6 p.m. Located at 1525 Newton Street Northwest in Columbia Heights, starting September 22nd. It's the Words, Beats, and Life After School Academy. More info at wblinc.org/academy.
All right.